of the subcommittee for purposes of taking testimony. So with that, we will go to open a public hearing, possible work session on Senate Bill 461, Vernon High Council.
Mr. Chair, the proponents and opponents, the parties to Senate Bill 461 have been meeting in work groups and are attempting to develop some amendments that would be acceptable to to all sides on the issue, and we'll report back to the chair sometime this week.
All right.
And we'll have another meeting.
For the record, anyone here testify on Senate Bill 461?
No.
Thank you. I just have to do that. Thank you very much. We close the public hearing work session 461. Open the public hearing work session on Senate Bill 1157.
Mr. Chair, the constituent for whom this bill was introduced is unexpectedly out of state today, and when he returns next week, we will have a more formal public hearing and work session on 1157.
Right. I believe this is the Senate George bill.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Chair.
Is it Senator George?
Senator George, Representative Lewis.
All right. Are you Senator George? Is Representative Lewis here? They're not here. Therefore, anybody want to testify in Senate Bill 1157? Not seeing or hearing anybody who wants to do that, close the public hearing work session on 1157. Now, here we go. I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2526, Learning the High Council.
What?
I mean, is this, we just start talking, or is it, when you take testimony, you go talk to the judge? That's it, Steve. Then we do the thing.
Mr. Chair, Senate, House Bill 2526.
Come in, come in.
Sorry. Can you please sign up? Oh, thank you. What? No, you can hear this. As soon as we get the silent sheet, we'll find out whether or not there's anybody out there. Okay, there's no one on the silent sheet.
Well, there's nobody on it.
Up to you whether or not you want to left.
Yeah, that's fine. Is there any amendments to this bill?
Mr. Chair, what it does is specifies that bounty hunters can't receive rewards of public money.
Bounty hunters cannot receive.
Yes.
Who introduced this bill? This is Representative Cruz.
Representative Cruz, Mr. Chair.
Is Representative Cruz in the... where is he? Is that good? And there's nobody... Well, you know... we can't move it anyway. You've only got two of us here.
Correct.
Well, all I can say is I'm going to close the hearing this time because no one's here to testify on it, but we opened it, so I closed the public hearing on House Bill 2526, which says bounty hunters cannot receive any public dollars. Yes, Senator, excuse me.
I think that it may not be just that, you know, nobody's here to testify, Mr. Chair. It could be that there are other members that aren't here, including others of all stripes and political persuasions, and we each have represented, you know, our parties well, but we got some busy people in this building. So I just wanted, for the record to know that it wasn't just that somebody wasn't here to testify.
Oh, that's correct. Right. What I'm trying to say is that these individuals are busy doing other public work and service for the good of humanity. So, all right. So, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2526. I worked at the House Bill 2526.
You can't do that
with
you, because you have witnesses.
Oh, good. Open the public hearing, House Bill 2558, and I'd like...
Sure. Mr. Chair, 2558 would delete the cap that currently exists in statute for the amount that someone can wager at a Monte Carlo or casino-type event and allows DOJ, the Department of Justice, to actually establish that cap by administrative rule.
Okay, like Rick Walker from Wild Bills and Ross Claiborne from the Department of Justice to come forward, please. Wild Bills. Let me just reset the views. Rick, you want to go first?
Sure. Thank you, Vice Chairman Courtney, Senator Q-Tub. My name's Rick Walker. I'm the owner of Wild Bills Northwest. We're a Portland company that specializes in interactive entertainment for corporate and charitable events. One of the types of events that we do quite a bit of are Monte Carlo nights for nonprofits. Last session, the legislature approved a measure recognizing Monte Carlo events as a permitted activity, and Wild Bills and some nonprofits worked on this bill with the Department of Justice to develop that legislation. Monte Carlo event is a 4 to 5 hour event held in a banquet facility where games like blackjack, craps, roulette are played using imitation money. The nonprofit organization may hire a company like ours to provide the gaming equipment and personnel to run it. The nonprofit sells tickets to the event that might also have a dinner or an auction. Players can purchase the imitation money to play the casino games. Players also have a chance to win prizes at the end of the evening based on how they did at the gaming tables, and these prizes are generally donated. After legislation was passed last session, we worked with the Department of Justice on development of the rules. We were generally pleased with the implementation of those rules. However, there were a couple of issues that came up that couldn't be addressed through the rulemaking process. Therefore, House Bill 2558 has been drafted to address these statutory changes. Under current statute, ORS 167118, Section 1, Subsection 1, it says no one other than licensed nonprofit organizations and their employees may profit in any manner from the operation of bingo, lotto, raffle, or Monte Carlo games. If strictly applied, the facility that rents the space for the event, the power company that sells the electricity, or the concessionaire who sells food, would be in violation of this statute. It also precludes a company from sponsoring a Monte Carlo event in return for publicity, and disallows employees of the sponsoring company from volunteering their time to collect donations for the charity. This poses a serious problem for small charities who rely on corporate sponsorships and their volunteers for such events. House Bill 2558 would amend the current provision to read, no one other than licensed nonprofit organizations and their employees may directly profit from the operation of bingo, lotto, raffle, or Monte Carlo games. This language change will still prohibit anyone other than the nonprofit organization from profiting from the gaming, but will allow them to take advantage of corporate sponsorships. This bill also eliminates subsection 6, Section 2, which states no person or player may wager in aggregate more than $200 at any single Monte Carlo event. This is a previous statute provision from the old Happy Canyon laws. The original intent was to protect gamblers of modest means from losing the rent money, the grocery money, and so on. In truth, the type of people who attend Monte Carlo events are members and guests of charities who are there to support the charity. The casino games are merely a fun way of providing an evening's entertainment with the opportunity to donate money to the organization through playing the games. Low-income or addicted gamblers are not drawn to these events because there's no possibility to win money. Games are played with imitation money, having no value, and the best they can do is have a chance to win a prize. There's never been a complaint in 16 years of someone spending more money than they could afford. In fact, our statistics show that the average guest at a Monte Carlo fundraiser spends $20 on imitation money during an event. The problem with the monetary limit is not so much the limit itself, but the requirement that a nonprofit organization report all players' purchases to the Department of Justice to prove that no one spent over $200. When you have an event with 200 to 500 guests, this could really be a logistical nightmare. We feel that a monetary limit, when there's never been a problem with overspending, puts an undue hardship on a nonprofit organization. If the $200 limit is eliminated and some unforeseen problem arises in the future, Section 2, Subsection 4 of House Bill 2558 allows the Department of Justice to establish by rule a maximum amount that the person may wager at one of these events. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Laybon.
Vice Chair Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Ross Laybon. I'm an assistant attorney general. I serve as the attorney in charge of the department's charitable activities section. As such, one of our responsibilities is supervising the oversight of charitable gaming, which as of the last legislative session now includes bingos, raffles, and the Monte Carlo events. I'm primarily here to be a resource for the committee. As far as we're concerned, both of these changes are improvements to the existing statute.
the deletion of the profiting in any manner in favor of direct profiting is a problem that's been around kind of since the inception of this law. It actually predates the Monte Carlo provision, and we think that's an appropriate change for the reasons that Mr. Walker mentioned. Also, we've had now the opportunity to track 1 year's worth of experience with the Monte Carlo events. We're just starting to get the financial reports from those events that took place in 1998. And I can tell you that as far as the events go, we've yet to see an event where the handle, the amount spent on the script, exceeds $10,000. It's typically in the $2,000 to $8,000 range. So we believe that, at least in the short run, deleting the $200 per player limit is not something that's going to open the floodgates to substantial gambling as a result of this vehicle.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Mr. Walker, Ms. Leyburn?
I have a couple questions, but first of all, I guess, Mr. Walker, how do you run your business without profiting?
We are actually a for-profit company. The way that it's set is that we have a license through the Department of Justice to operate Monte Carlo nights for charitable organizations or organizations that have nonprofit status. We charge a flat fee for a setup, a casino based on the number of people. And so we charge the organization a flat fee. We provide the equipment, the supplies, the personnel, and then that allows the organization to do a professional casino night where they take all the profits from the event that night.
There is a sense in which you get paid for what you're doing. I was
wondering
how you did that. Then I guess I would ask a question about how you know that people playing at Monte Carlo, even for these fundraisers and nonprofits, are not addicted gamblers.
We've been doing Monte Carlo nights for over 16 years. The fact that it's generally open to members and guests of nonprofit organizations. It's not something that's just opened up, but a site and anybody from off the street can walk in. So people first have to purchase a ticket ahead of time. The ticket allows them in the door, and then they can purchase script after that. People that are addicted to gambling, first of all, the reason or what enthuses them is the chance to win money and the kind of the thrill of gambling. We take that out because they're not playing against the house. They're playing against other players. And there's only a chance to win a prize. If somebody spends money at the casino gaming, they even if they do real well at the tables, they have a chance to win a prize. There's no guarantee. So that takes that whole conception of winning money out of it for them. So those type of people that are addicted are generally at the video poker machines.
I know many of them probably are, but I don't know personally. I know of the fact that, you know, it isn't just low-income people that are addicted to gambling, and they will. I think people that are addicted to gambling will use whatever means they can to play the game, have the risk, and they get all wrapped up in the whole issue of risk and everything else. And of course, they want to win money, and they because they're addicted, they lose all the time and keep thinking they'll get the big jackpot. But in some ways, I guess I question the fact that you can really know that people who come aren't addicted. I understand I've been to plenty of these events, but I think a lot of addicted gamblers are not. It isn't evident.
Well, that's true. Somebody could be there that is, and you're right, we wouldn't know who they were. Just our statistics do based on buying script. They generally buy script at a higher rate. They may spend $10 to get $100 in script to play with. Our average over those years has been the average person spending $20. And it's somewhat difficult to spend a lot more than that, although I have to admit throughout the years there have been people that have come in and spend way more than $200. It's generally somebody who has the means, who wants to support the organization and knows where that money's going to.
Further questions for the witnesses? Senator Kyle? Learned High Council? All right. Senator Burnham, we're moving the statutory cap amount.
Yeah.
Could we put the bill?
I don't think we're moving it, are we, Mr. Chair? I thought we were having a public hearing.
Are you going? Oh, is it going to another work session? I see. Well, that's it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2558. And let's go to, let me open this, the second page, servers, and look at, open the work session, Senate Bill 846. Heard my counsel, please.
Mr. Chair, you just heard this bill last week, and this is the bill that would, as a budget, classify two cases that have had in peer support counseling sessions for law enforcement personnel, and now with the amendments, emergency services provider firefighters as confidential. And at that time, the witnesses and members of the committee expressed a couple concerns that are addressed in the dash 8 amendments, namely, the first of which, that the bill also be amended to apply to firefighters, which it does in the dash 8 amendment. And then the amendments also page 2, line 9, specify, lines 9 through 15, specify the communications to which the confidentiality does not extend. And I think the witnesses talked to you about any sex of suicide or homicide or any information relating to abuse of children or the elderly, you know, under the mandatory reporter statute. But also now, on line 15, the amendment indicated that confidentiality would not extend to any admission of criminal conduct that might take place during the session. I do understand that at least Mr. Zalashman is interested in coming before the committee to actually express for the record what the intent of that provision is, but as he does that, I'll also point out that the amendments, while the bill will allow peer support counselors to talk with each other and, you know, compare notes and work for the best benefit of the employees of the counseling, the amendments specify that their discussions are also confidential. Discussions among them, among each, between themselves, among each other, are also confidential.
Yeah.
And with that, that's the extent of the dash 8 amendment.
Yeah, so I think here's the comment.
Mr. Chair, the dash 8 are kind of the working product. We think they finally got there. There's been dash 4s, 5s, and so forth. There was a couple of concerns. They have been resolved, as your counsel has indicated to you. The one concern we had on the previous version was that any counselor that communicated to their supervisor who's a counselor, that information was not, in fact, confidential. That's been taken care of. The one comment that I do have, though, on page 2, line 15, and I wanted to have, at least on the record, some discussion about, we had absolutely no objections to admission of criminal activity not being protected. The one thing that I wanted to howler communicate to you is that we think there's a difference between the admission of criminal activity and, or say, for example, a police officer in an officer-involved shooting in a peer support situation questioning what actually happened immediately after the fact, talking to the police officer and saying, you know, did they have a gun, did they not have a gun, you know, it was dark, did they, you know, they reached down here, it looks like this is happening. That, in fact, is dealing with the circumstances and trying to get the emotions out for the facts of the investigation, which are going on separately, can continue to go on. But that's a police officer venting versus a police officer saying, I shot my wife or I stole breakfast from my neighbor, which is an admission of guilt. And that was the only little tweak that I was concerned about that language. I'm convinced that the language is okay the way it is, but I wanted to have a little dialogue with you about the difference between admission of the commission of a crime and a discussion in a counseling session questioning the facts about what happened. The officer I know is in, we had communication prior to this work session, and
and maybe she can address that. But she said it's quite normal for a police officer to have a dialogue during these peer sessions about what actually happened.
Do you have any comments?
I don't. I just had these amendments drafted and it was just along to facilitate the discussion as well.
Okay.
Cindy Rose here from the Portland Police Bureau might want to make some comments.
With regard to what the...
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Officer Cindy Rose from the Portland Police Bureau, and I actually work in the Employee Assistance Program. Oftentimes when we have debriefings with officers, I'm not sure that second-guessing what they did regarding, oh, I saw this and this is what I did, but maybe it's a second-guessing, maybe I should have tried this first before I did that. And because you are going to question what you did. It's just a natural response that you are going to have those feelings and those thoughts. And the whole idea of the debriefing is to be able to come in and share that emotion and get support for what you did. And if there is an opportunity or a problem with what they did, that's going to be investigated because every shooting is investigated as a criminal occurrence through the detectives, through internal affairs if there's a problem. And that part of it is separate because all we're dealing with is the mental health part of it.
Senator Carroll, any questions or concerns of these witnesses?
Mr. Chairman, my only questions I think they were answered last time we talked to these folks were where are the administrators on this issue and the officer concerned chiefly and the chief move for supportive of it. I haven't heard from any of the county sheriff, but maybe that the fact they haven't come forward is acceptance of the bill
I believe that may be only because the advent of peer support in the Oregon Police Agency is new, and they may not have a peer support team at this time.
Very briefly, if I may, Brian Galashin again, Oregon Sheriff's Police Association. I've had conversations with Russ Spencer from the sheriff. He said that at that point, I don't know if it's current, but at that point, the Sheriff's Association had not taken a position and just hadn't come up before their sheriffs yet. But his feeling was that they wouldn't have a problem. So I don't want to put words in his mouth, but they, at that point of the hearing, had not taken a position.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, if they haven't, they're aware of this, and if by now they haven't come forward and taken a position, I want to take care of the task of
approval. Senator Chief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the issue of the line 15 about the, on page 2, the any definition of criminal conduct, I'm wondering if a situation where the officer told us about a situation where you kind of, well, I could have done it differently. What about a situation where during that debriefing an officer would say, well, I saw the person move, I thought they had a weapon, and the split second before I shot them, I saw they didn't have it, but it was too late. Would that be considered something that could be held against that officer?
I think that would be a very difficult question because it would actually become an issue of was it a justified shooting, and that would have to go through the detective division, and they would be telling that story there, I would hope. You know, and I'm not sure how that would be handled. I'm thinking that if you're in the middle of a shooting and a person, you know, they don't have to have a gun. They have to make furtive movements that lead you to believe that your life is in danger. And at that point, you believed with all your heart that that was the case, and you took that action. And it may be at that last moment that you don't have any time to stop, but the action's done, and you took it with good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
And which would be a very important reason why you're having a diversion.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Furtive movements would be considered a defense. As far as law enforcement officers are concerned, if they can show that the person made furtive movements, even though the person may not have been armed, and in case law where they've been reaching for the billfold, a deaf mute in L.A., there was a stop one night behind the liquor store was closed, and the officer drew down on him, and the guy reached for his billfold, and he got blown away. And the officer was held not responsible because of furtive movement aspect of it, as well as no criminal negligence on this part. He's acting in good faith. Good faith is totally acceptable standard.
Okay, and that's why, Mr. Chair, I asked the question because you'd think that normal good faith issues, even if they did come up, would not be held against the officer.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I've been thinking about this since we heard this bill. This whole issue, I think it's really a shame to our criminal defense bar because of the fact that we have to be so careful not to say certain things so that when a person goes to court, an officer who's out there putting their life on the line all the time has to defend themselves against that. Remembering, I mean, I know that we have to defend people. I'm not saying that people shouldn't be defended, but some of the issues that were brought forward and some of the fears by the officers of sharing certain things in a debriefing, to me, seems kind of a shame that we have to be so careful that this would actually be held against them in that way.
Senator Courtney moves the Dash 8 Amendment to Senate Bill 846. Discussion, please. Is there any objection to that? Hearing none. Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 846 as amended before the due pass motion. Discussion, please. Any objections? Senator Turner, would you carry this, please, as a former law enforcement officer?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. For you, I do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
I just thought that you knew about the trauma, and you might be able to give some insight to the chair.
Talk about trauma. We had him before today. I'll do.
So, Mr. Chair, I'd love to say.
Wait a minute. We got one more bill to do.
Okay, do it quickly. I'm well, 3:30 meeting with the governor's office.
Work session on Senate Bill 202.
Mr. Chair, the committee heard this bill early February, in mid-February. This is the Board of Investigators bill that Section 1 expanded the number of folks who actually registered with the Board of Investigators as investigators. But then the next few sections of the bill just deal with the difference between errors and omissions, insurance, and bonds. Basically, we put in, errors and omissions, insurance to stand in place of how you actually post a bond. The point being that most times, errors and omissions, insurance actually cost more than a bond, protects folks more than a bond, but the statutory scheme doesn't allow the Board of Investigators to actually accept that as the bond requirement or replace the bond requirement. So that's one of the things that you have before you, delete Section 1 of the bill. So they take out the expansion of the registration requirement, but permit the Board of Investigators to utilize the irrevocable letter of credit or error of omission insurance in place of the bond. So the controversial section, I think, is removed by the Dash 1, but the housekeeping, if you will, changes are going to be left intact.
In accordance with the Dash 1 amendments, we'll go through those two. Discussion, please. Objection. According to 202, Senate Bill 202 is a matter of the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. All right.
I move Senator Courtney carry that bill.
Just Chair Bryant, since he's not.
Oh, Chair Bryant.
Yeah, Senator Bryant will carry that bill.
Good idea.
I do want to stand in recess for a minute because we've got these other two bills we could. I can move to the floor, but I'll lose Senator Brown. I wonder if I can pick up James or Senator Burdick or Senator Nelson somewhere. Because I need to see I'd like to move some of the right. So Senator, these two bills can go. I'd like to see if anything go otherwise, right?
Yeah, sure. There was no testimony in 3526, but it did. Effect of the bill is to remove the statutory cap of $1,000 that has to be on Gouchy Hunter rewards that Gouchy Hunter will receive, but also specifies that whatever money they might receive shall not be, cannot be public funds.
Yeah, that's right. So, and that's where you see you arrived, I think, Senator Brown, Senator Turner, that's what that bill's all about. We haven't. Nobody testifying on bills, so I don't know. Maybe we should
send them over tomorrow. Oh, I can't
expect
them
now.
I'll move it.
All right. Let's try it. See what happens. If people aren't
well,
comfortable with
before I move it. Are we okay?
It retains the law exactly as it is now, except for removing the monetary cap.
Right.
I think
that's not
going to
help us, no matter what it is.
Senator, Kikon has moved House Bill 2526 and goes to the floor to do pass recommendation. Discussion, please. Is there any objection? So be it. The bill is now before and it's gone.
Well, why don't we just call everybody back here at 4 and I'll be done with my meeting and we can save the 100 business.
Let's try that, because the Senator Kikon is not...
Which one do we want?
Does not wish to move the Monte Carlo Night 255 at the floor. So. Did they not do that?
Yeah.
No, that's over. That was the floor, right?
Why don't we come back at 4?
4:15? Who? Anybody want to carry
2-5? I will carry 2-5-2-6.
It's okay, Senator. Well, it has to, but yes.
No, I will do it.
Senator Brown wishes to carry 2526A in gross. I guess it's a standing recess here, so let's try...
Okay, 4:15.
Okay, 4:15, and then nobody shows are done.
Okay.
Chairman, before you do that, may I please beg unanimous consent to vote aye on House Bill 2526, Senate Bill 202, and Senate Bill 846, and... That's it.
Think it's a better game?
Oh, no, she didn't have to go down.
So I missed the whole dog on her.
I will be good.
That's the committee. You have to send the vote on 2526. Senate Bill 846. Right? And also Senate Bill 202. Is that correct? Is there any objection? Hearing none. So how do you cast your vote, please?
I vote aye, Mr. Chairman. I do not believe it changes the outcome, although I don't know for sure.
That does not change the outcome. So that the record shows Senate Bill votes aye on the three designated bills.
Mr. Chair, are we in work session on House Bill 2558?
I'm now moving to open the work session on House Bill 2558, and now work session on Bill 2558.
Mr. Chair, I move forward with the cast recommendation. I'm very happy to be the carrier.
Senator Brown has moved House Bill 2558 as well as the due pass recommendation, as beseeched me to carry the bill as well. There is discussion on the motion. Any objection to the motion? It is done, and Senator Brown will carry House Bill 2558. Any of this come for the committee?
Yes, we are meeting tomorrow.
The primary witness for that bill was out of state today, and no one else came to testify on it, so we had the public hearing to explain that, but the committee is meeting tomorrow, Mr. Chair, from 1 to approximately 3 o'clock.
Midnight.
3:05.
Well, 3:05?
Well, you know, I'm actually... Sure that I need to leave by 2:30 tomorrow. I'll let
that. We're adjourned for this week. Well, I'll be here until we're done, which means I'll...